You're listening to a special double feature of
the Outdoor Adventures Podcast,
the Oregon First Hunting and Fishing Podcast. Thank you for joining. We're so glad that you decided to listen to our show today. Today's kind of a special episode. Not only are we recording remotely with John Stallone, who's out in Arizona with Howl for Wildlife, and you know, we don't normally do remote recordings. It's kind of a special case here.
Nice.
But also, this is a double feature between the Oregon First Hunting and Fishing Podcast and the Outdoor Adventures Podcast with Sam.
Yeah, thanks. Thanks for having me.
Yeah.
Thanks for letting me crash the party.
Yeah, we're here in our Salem studio, but maybe we'll reverse the roles and do a double feature. We'll be down at your place next time.
Hey, you're welcome anytime.
All right, sounds good. We'll get Donald Trump on.
Yeah, yep. I'm sure.
Yeah.
He's not very busy. He signed a few executive orders yesterday.
Yeah. Wasn't one of those executive orders to make hunting and fishing a right for all American citizens?
That sounds good to me. I don't know.
Part
I
of
didn't
the high
hear
school
them
curriculum
all.
Now? Maybe, maybe not. Thank you for tuning in. And John, thank you for joining us all the way from Arizona.
No, thanks. Thanks for having me. Appreciate it. Don't mind the messy office background here. I don't have quite the nice setup like you guys got.
Oh man, if only you could see what is on the other side of the camera. and I cleaned this office just a couple days ago in preparation, but normally it looks like a hoarder's house in here.
I didn't. So I washed my hunting clothes. They're on the floor right there, and my sons are right there.
So, oh, awesome.
I got stuff everywhere. I didn't have a chance to
wrapping up, so it's time to clean all that stuff. So in this episode, we're going to talk about the new Blacktail Federation brought to you by the Mule Deer Foundation, or that's the Blacktail Foundation, not Federation. It's not the Wild Turkey Federation, you know, all those
Brian's sporting the Blacktail Deer Foundation hat.
They sent me a hat because I decided to join when they started that up. We're also going to talk about Howl for Wildlife and have a conversation with our guest, John Stallone. So for those of you who don't know John, he is a hunting guide, host of the podcast Days in the Wild, an outdoor writer, just creates all kinds of outdoor content, and also the vice president and co-founder of Howl for Wildlife.
Thank you.
So John, thanks again for being here. Really appreciate it. This is something I didn't really give you a warning of in our pre-notes, but we always do surprise icebreakers with the guests. So Sam's going to take you through those.
All right, John. Fishing or hunting?
Oh, hunting by far.
Bow or rifle?
Bow.
And this one, Bryant was just trying to get another question.
I just had to come up with five.
Ford or Chevy?
Ford.
All right. All right.
Ford guy. We're both, you know, Ford guys.
Yeah, we're all Ford guys, but
I drive a Raptor,
out here in Oregon, I feel like we kind of stand out because I meet so many GM, Chevy, you know, Dodge guys. Toyota is huge, but you know,
I've been all of them. I've had all of them.
Yeah.
And
Ford, huh?
Well, you know what? I got to tell you, it's not that we're going to get down this rabbit hole here, but so I was sponsored by Chevy for a while, and I loved the truck for my contracting business, and I hated it for hunting. Like, I feel like I needed to get go to the chiropractor or something every time I got back out from and I had a Toyota Tundra right before. I currently have a Ford Raptor, 2020 Raptor. Well, it's not a brand new one, but it's literally the best truck I've ever owned. I didn't do a thing to it. I put lights on it. I put lights on it. That's it.
I have a 2015 F-150 and it's been in the shop for 6 weeks and I've been missing it.
That's
not a good sign for plug for Ford.
Yeah.
It's been in the shop for 6 weeks.
When they get done with
Let's keep going. Let's keep going.
So Arizona or Oregon?
Well, I've hunted both, and obviously because I live here, but I've been to Oregon quite a bit. I love hunting in Oregon, but I'd have to go with my home state, Arizona.
Is that because of the terrain or the animals?
Both.
Both. Wow. Okay.
Yeah. One thing about Oregon that, I mean, I've only hunted rosies out there. Oh, I've hunted blacktail too. What am I talking about? But it's, that boreal rainforest thing going on there.
Yep.
I was every time I went there, I was like, oh yeah, it's a dry season. And I was literally rained on every single damn day.
Well, I don't remember. I mean, that's only like a quarter of the state, which happens to be the part of the state that we're in. And that, you know, I've spent all my hunting in that kind of terrain. Sam, he goes out east a lot more for mule deer. So that'll kind of give you a perspective on sort of who we are and what we like to do.
Gotcha.
Well, I can tell you, I have nice boots finally this year, and blacktail hunting this year, I had like an inch and a half in water, even in the nice boots. Like no matter how good your boots are, the water's going to get in.
Yep.
You know? Oh yeah. I was in full, you know, $500 Sitka rain gear and everything. And then the salmon berries just poke holes in everything. And it's like, it's not a, I mean, I totally enjoy hunting there, but it's, if you're going to compare it to hunting here, it's not the same. Yep.
Well, a good tip for the listener on that front. I still invest in decent rain jackets, but rain pants, just get those $20 Walmart ones because you're going to go through them, you know, for every season. So you got to get a new one for blacktail and for elk and then for whatever else you're doing.
You're going to tear them up. And the last question we got is deer or elk?
Yes. You know, it really just depends. The thing about deer is you can hunt them in so many more, the opportunities so much greater. And there's so many really different species of deer. Like, you know, you have the blacktail, the mule deer, the coos deer, the whitetail. And that in itself, you know, if you had to put a gun to my head, would probably pick that. But I do prefer chasing bugles in the rut over anything.
I mean, for me, the elk are just so charismatic. Like, I'll always be a blacktail first guy because it's just what's in my blood. It's how I began my life in the outdoors. But, you know, now that I've really started chasing elk the last few years, there's that big, huge animal screaming at you, man.
Yeah.
And I haven't even really had that many experiences with them up close screaming at you, you know. Just the far-off bugle will give you an adrenaline rush.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, nothing like banshees in the dark in the middle of the woods.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Awesome. Well, now that we know everything about John Stallone,
all
that we need to
stuff.
Know, let's just have a quick conversation about what's up in the outdoors. So, Sam, do you do much duck hunting?
I've never duck hunted. So my uncles were big duck hunters.
Okay.
And they did some amateur taxidermy with their ducks.
Oh.
And so they took some sort of courses back in the day. So they had duck and geese all over the place. So they were big duck hunters. And my dad used to duck hunt with them before I was born. And he would always say how cold and miserable it was. And so then he never really wanted to do it with us as kids. I've pheasant hunted a few times and some chucker and grouse, but I've won a duck hunt. I just haven't.
Yeah. Well, you might have missed the ship for this year. Season's winding down. But John, how about you? Have you done any duck hunting?
I did quite a bit of it when I was younger.
Sure.
I only get so many get out of jail free cards a year, and I prefer to chase big game. So I'm not much of a bird hunter. But I do. I've gone my fair share.
Yeah.
And we do a lot of puddle jumping here.
Okay.
So there's a lot of little desert tanks. And it's kind of cool because you stalk up on it and you peek over the berm and.
Oh man.
It's a little different. I mean, I've done the decoy thing too and calling and all that.
Sure.
But
I mean, that's like totally different than any kind of hunting we do out here.
Sure.
You know, I've been spending a lot of time on the river the last couple of years, but before that it was mostly just coastal hunting. I don't know, John, have you ever had the opportunity to hunt like a tidal area?
No.
Because you got lots of those in Arizona, right?
Yeah, totally. No, but so if you haven't heard from my accent, I'm originally from New York and I lived in Long Island.
Okay, got
Long Island has a lot of duck hunting. That's pretty competitive too, because you have to like put in for like a lottery type system
for the blind.
For coastal blinds and stuff, yeah.
Yep.
No, I haven't. I've hunted them with my bow, like, you know, stalking with a bow.
That's cool.
Like I said, I've tank jumped or puddle jumped.
Yeah, yeah.
And I've done decoying, you know, waders and waiting for them to fly over and doing the duck calls and stuff. I've never done flooded fields. I've never done flooded timber. I've always wanted to.
Sure.
Never did layouts for like geese or anything like that. I've always wanted to do that, but I've never done it.
Yeah. Yeah. No, I mean, you're kind of naming a lot of the stuff that a lot of people do out here, especially in the Willamette Valley, where it's either that. But what I was saying about the coast, though, is you got to really watch the tide. Because in the ducks, they don't really fly so much by first light. You know, you'll still get that first light flight. But It's really when the water comes in and floods all the grass, that's when the ducks want to come in and feed. And so this 2 weekends ago, and some of you probably saw my post on Instagram about the boat getting stuck. I mean,
I saw that.
That was an experience. So we're out in this big flooded sand flat, and we just, with the way that first light was working with the tide, we kind of picked a weird time to go out. We actually went out when the tide was already halfway up. Then we hunted all of high slack. And then as the tide was going out, there was just so many birds that we couldn't help it. We stayed past our welcome. And so we start, we're thinking, okay, we just got to call it. We got to get back to the truck. Let's go ahead and head back. So we're, you know, I'm ramping the boat up, trying to get back as fast as we can. And my motor is kind of crappy. It's from 1970 and it dies at full throttle. So I can only do like 3/4 throttle. And I'm trying to get back up while the tide's blowing out. And all of a sudden the motor's bouncing off the sand. So okay, all right, let's start paddling. So I'm using my push pole. And then before you know it, you know, we're out, we're pushing the boat, and then we start to feel it drag on the bottom. Mm. And within maybe 2 minutes of that, the boat is just locked into that super wet, muddy, sandy stuff. And the thing is, like, you'd think, oh, you could just slide it over that, but it sucks it down like a suction cup. And so we started trying to lift the back of the boat and push with all of our strength. And we made it maybe 20 yards before we were just cooked. I was like on the edge of throwing up from physical exertion. And so we actually had to leave the boat way out in the middle. It was a whole mile walk through the bay, the empty bay, back to the truck, got some dinner, came back out in the middle of the night. And I was actually set to preach that next Sunday morning. So the day after. And so I, you know, I have to be ready at like 7 a.m. or whatever for that.
Yeah.
And so we're like, listen, the boat's not going to be floating in water again until about midnight. We need to just man up and get this thing out of there. And so
did you drop an anchor?
Yeah. Just in case, but the tide, you know, it was a negative tide swing that day.
Oh,
and
man.
So we left when the water was at +2 feet. That's when the boat was on dry land. And so there was still a whole nother 3 feet down, and then it had to come back up that plus some in order to float the boat. And so after all that, we just decided to man up. You know, we walked all the way back out there, and we just started muscling this thing across the bay. And we finally figured out the trick. And this is for anyone who ever finds himself in that situation. Find some wood, like wood planks, wood, anything that you can find, and throw it in the sand in front of the boat, because it breaks that suction. Mm-hmm. And so when we did that, we started making some progress, and we got out of there by 11:30. And then we get to the boat ramp, and the bottom of the boat ramp is still 2 feet out of the water. So after all of that, we still had to, well, what we ended up doing is completely emptying the boat, because it's just an aluminum boat. You know?
Oh, so you probably could have carried it. Yeah.
Yeah. We completely emptied it and just used all of our strength to get it nosed up onto the trailer, and then hooked the cable and cranked it up and got home. And so that's the story of the warning of the tidal hunting. And the funny thing is, my buddy Jericho, who's on the show a lot, he's the one who kind of taught me how to duck hunt. And he's always warned me about the bays and the tide. And so when I posted that picture, his first response was, you know, I think a good friend of yours warned you about that.
Told you. Don't stay out too long. Yeah.
So there you go. That's my story. But I mean, for most anyone who doesn't duck hunt, I mean, seasons are kind of over, right? What about you guys? Do you have anything going on, or is it?
Oh yeah. Arizona's. We got to the end of this month for deer, archery deer.
Oh really?
This is our rut. Man. Right now is January's the rut.
Although no way.
The season's been dry and not great.
Man, I would have never thought that. You know, I have no knowledge of hunting in that part of the country.
Well, yeah, our friend Nathan Endicott just got back from there. And so he bought a 2024 tag and a 2025 tag because he didn't have very many days left in 24 to hunt.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And he was able to get two nice mule deer.
I saw that he got those, yeah. But I wouldn't have thought it was a rut hunt. I would have thought it was kind of like winding down the winter. So you're... When do your bucks drop their antlers?
I've seen them packing in May.
Wow, that's insane. Ours are already dropping, you know?
Yeah.
That's crazy, man.
Yeah.
Cool. So
we have javelina hunting Archery season ends, so today is 21st. It ends on the 23rd. That's all, two more days of javelina hunting for archery.
Okay.
And unless it's a metro tag and that goes to the end of the month.
Well, who was it that recently added javelina to the records? Was it
Boone and Crockett?
Boone and Crockett?
Yeah.
You going for a Booner?
Maybe.
Maybe.
I don't ever put anything in the books. I'm sure I have several book animals, but I don't...
Oh, really?
I put my Ibex when I shot that in SEI. Yeah, SEI. But
okay. Well, what's your reasoning for that?
That, and I put an antelope that I had shot because it was a number 11 at the time, spawn stalk. Wow. For archery from Pope and Young, but that's it. That's the only three things I ever put in a book. I don't even score them.
Why do you do that?
I don't score them. I don't know. Just don't have it.
Yeah.
I mean, if it makes me happy, I don't care, you know?
Yeah, I guess that's true.
There was a stint in my life that I was like trying to keep up with the Joneses and I really cared about what inches were. Now, I mean, it's been a very long time since I have, over 20 years probably. Yeah.
So do you drink the Kool-Aid on the whole thing about how those record books are good for tracking population dynamics and the health of a population, or do you just kind of think it's...
I don't know. I don't know that I would call it Kool-Aid, but there's some validity to that. I think the biggest thing behind that is that hunting is such a chest-beating endeavor that it helps keep engagement, and it helps bring in funding for things that are necessary, even though the bait, so to speak, or the tool isn't really that, you know. It's not like, if that makes sense. It does. It's kind of a double-edged sword, in my opinion. I think it in the non-hunting public's eye, it has some stigma attached to it. It has it gives us a little bit of a black eye sometimes.
Yeah.
But if you look at the organizations that are doing that record keeping, for the most part, their record is impeccable for what they do for conservation. So
yeah,
it's definitely not something I like to see go away.
Kind of a double-edged sword.
I don't have a problem with it personally, and I never. And my reasoning for not doing it is not because I don't believe in it. It's not important to me.
I think there's always some excitement as hunters when you see a new record animal taken. We get those in our feeds, and we read the article, and you hear the story.
Yeah,
and
like that elk from Washington.
Yeah, it's always exciting to see.
But look at that. Okay, let's talk about that. There's just as many, maybe not as many, but seemingly there's just as many people bashing Casey for that as there is praising him for it.
And
it creates another level. Like I said, it's a very chest beating sport, or I don't even like to call it a sport because it's not a sport, but endeavor. It creates another level of jealousy, another level of, if that guy's doing it, he must be cheating. There's always this, if I can't do it, how can that guy do it? Bullshit. Excuse my French. Sorry.
Yep. No worries.
You might have to bleep that out.
Everybody always says high fence.
There's always an excuse. So it's a backyard buck. It's a backyard bull. It's a high fence. He did it illegally. Blah, blah, blah. You know, there's all this thing.
Yeah.
And
on that comment, I always think it's funny when people use that backyard buck or backyard bull kind of a thing. Like, I've always heard stories of people going out on their back deck on their bathrobe and sticking a big old buck, but in my experience of trying to chase backyard buck, they also don't want to die.
They know how to avoid people. They know how to avoid people. They're used to people. Yeah. They know how to avoid them.
And they're so good at it. And so I'll see some of the biggest bucks on cam. Someone will show me this like bottom of the Willamette Valley right next to town, monster blacktail. Like, I actually found a deadhead in the park recently that would have been a lifetime 3x3 for anyone, like just this huge buck. And he's just right in the middle of everything, you know, like they know how to not be seen or nocturnal. I mean, that's an aside from the point that you're bringing up, but I mean, that one always cracks me up. Like, sometimes the backyard bucks come into your lap, but a lot of the time...
Oh, yeah. Listen, you can be out in the middle of nowhere and that happened. I've had that happen. Like, I was sitting there glassing and I look over to my right and here comes a friggin' deer. Like, I mean, I'm not going to capitalize on that.
My first buck was like 10 yards away from me, you know, kind of a deal. So,
yeah. Well, I also think on the positive side, as hunters, you see these big animals harvested and you're like, oh, there's still some big ones out there. Because I think sometimes we get in this mindset that all the big ones were taken, you know, and then you see giants and you're like, wow, there are some big ones, you know?
Yeah, I did see a guy post something about, oh, it'll never be broken because of guys like him, influencers ruining, there's no more big deer or big elk.
I saw that same post.
And I'm like, first off, that makes no sense. And I wanted to say something. I was going to DM the guy. I was going to personally send him a message. I wasn't going to blast him on his feed. Really wanted to ask him where he came to that conclusion, you know, because if you know anything about the science of what's going on, that's not even a factor. You know, it's not a factor at all. So, but anyway, I don't want to get into a whole mess.
Sure. It's an interesting thing to talk about for sure, though, especially, you know, guys like you who have been hunting for many, many years and can get in on some nice bucks. I mean, I'm looking at the bucks behind you. And what's that right behind you above your left shoulder?
Oh, this one right here?
Yeah.
It's a mule deer. It's it's a dinky buck, in my opinion, but he's a nice looking buck. I don't know. Yeah. He's probably like a wolf.
I'm a blacktail hunter, so I mean, that's
It's an Arizona O2C buck that I shot some years ago.
Was that a bow buck or a rifle buck?
Bow buck. Nice. I've only killed two mule deer with a rifle.
Got it. The rest are all bow. Yeah. Nice. Yeah, I'm bow hunting for deer this year, or I did this year, and I'm going to next year just for scheduling reasons, but I might go back to rifle just because everyone always talks down on rifle hunters. And
yeah, that's honestly, and we can get into that, like that's one of our biggest problems in this, I'll call it a community, you know, in our community is that we are our own worst enemies in so many ways. We're always bashing, and it goes to what we were just talking about, Casey Brooks. We're always bashing on each other for how we do it, where we did it, the size of the animal, the smell on your friggin', you know, that you were using. I mean, whatever. There's always something, and it comes down, like I said, it's always, if you don't have something nice to say about the way, you know, it goes back to that thing that your mom taught you when you were a kid. If you don't have something nice to say, you don't say it at all. You know, listen, we all do things. We all are in this endeavor for different reasons.
Sure.
Some of us are hell bent on getting the biggest, the baddest thing out there. Some of us are about the method and how we do it. Some of us are, oh, it's got to be done this way. You know, the trad hunter, the whatever. And it's all fine. As long as it's done within the legal, like, you know, people who are poaching, that's a different story. That's, you know, if you're cheating, like actual cheating, then please.
Yeah, completely agree. Yeah.
Let's weed those people out. You know, if you want to shoot a spike buck, go shoot a spike buck, especially if it's your first deer.
Right.
You know, I'm of the camp, like, if it's your first deer or your child or, you know, your youth, go for it.
Uh-huh.
I mean, I'm not the guy to say, hey, go shoot that every time. If you're going to shoot a spike, might as well just shoot a doe, right? If you're out there just for the meat is what I'm saying. You know, if you're just out there for the meat, then let that buck grow. You know, I'm not going to look down at my nose because you wanted to shoot a spike.
Uh-huh.
It's not, you know, that's what made you happy. It was done legally. It was done within the parameters of the season that was set. And you do you, you know?
Well, and I think for those of us here, hunting is a lifestyle. So it's something that is part of our life that we're going to keep doing, and we're going to have longer seasons. And like John said, when we first started talking, it's getting those days that you're allowed to get. So my season went a little longer this year than it probably should have. And I pushed it with my wife a little bit, but I enjoyed what I was doing, and I got some hunts in, and my son got his first two bucks, and you know, it was, but to me, everyone starts at a different level, and I'm not going to judge a guy that, all of us had to start somewhere. And if it's your first time in the woods and maybe you only have one weekend to hunt and you're able to harvest an animal, I feel like as a community, we should all be celebrating that. You know, this guy was able to go out and get it done.
Uh-huh. Yeah, we need a lot more of that, a lot more of that mentality. And unfortunately, you know, we're all trapped in our echo chamber. So
yeah,
it probably seemingly feels that way because we surround ourselves with people that are more like-minded. You know, I don't know what, I don't remember looking at your social media as far as what kind of reach you had or whatever. You know, my reach kind of gets a lot more outside of my echo chamber. So there's, I get a lot of different views. It's cool. But then at the same time, I do see a lot of this stuff. I see a lot of this bashing.
Yeah.
And it's like, I'm already a sin eater when it comes to, you know, the stuff that's happening with anti-hunting. It's very hard for me to even get involved. Like, it's hard for me to not get involved, but it's also hard for me to get involved every time I see, like, I want to go protect that person. You know, I want to go, leave that guy alone. Come on, listen, what did he do wrong? You know, I know Casey very well. And I on many occasions wanted to come to his rescue when I see people and hear people talking like that about it. Cause he called me and we had a conversation about it. And I was like, yeah, man, I feel you. Cause I've been a victim of that too.
Yeah. We see it a lot with Cam Haynes around here. So he'll post a bear hunt or something.
Sure.
And everybody just lays into him.
Because, he's a big name person and they can't understand how Cam will go on 9 hunts a year and have 9 dead animals when they go on 2 hunts a year and they can't even score 1, you know? Yeah. And it's not to put anybody down. You got to understand that Cam dedicated his life to perfecting whatever it is that he does that, you know, allows him to have that success. You can't fault that guy. You know, I got an interesting story about Cam that I don't think I've ever really told. I had asked him to be on my podcast back in, I don't know, like 2015 or something like that. And I never got an answer back from him. And I guess I developed a little bit of animosity. I was like, man, you know, at the time, my podcast was like the 3rd largest podcast in hunting. And I was like, you know, why is this guy not? He's too cool for me. What? Like, and so I ran into him personally at the Mule Deer Foundation show. And I said that to him. I told him, I said, what, are you too cool to be like on my podcast? And, it just comes to the fact that he never saw it because he gets bombarded with all this stuff.
Yeah.
I started thinking about it and I'm like, you know, why was I mad at this guy? And why did I start thinking about all these things in my head? I don't even know them. And that's it. We don't even know these people that we see on social media, that we see on TV or YouTube or whatever. We don't know them. We develop these ideas. They might be the best people. They might be complete jerk-offs too, but and there is that. We can't say that there isn't that. Like I said, I've been a victim of it. Many times I've seen posts about me. Oh, he doesn't even know how to, he doesn't skin his own animals or I'm an outfitter guy. Come on. Like I skin more animals in a year than you have in your whole life. You know, stuff like that. But when you break it down, you start thinking about it. You're like these people, they develop an idea about what they see. And this works both ways too. Like you see all this, elaborate stuff. You don't see them for the stuff that goes bad, right? You develop an idea of who this person is and automatically, instead of being supportive of what they are and how they do things and so on and so forth, you start putting that on your own life. And you start thinking about it like, oh, well, like I said, it's this jealousy thing or this, why can't I do that? What about this person? You know, so you start making up these things to make yourself feel better. You're like, oh, he's got to be cheating. He's got to be doing this. This is, all this kind of stuff. And it's not, one, it's not a healthy way to live. And every time I catch myself doing it, because I'm a human, I'm not sitting up here on a soapbox preaching to people. You gotta have that realization and say, oh, let's take this for what this is. And instead of me putting this guy down, one, you got a chance to get to know him because maybe he's got some knowledge or whatever. If he is having this, she is having this kind of success, maybe I can learn from them,
Exactly. And that social media is such a, there's a lot of positives that come with it, but the negatives and how people can go so extreme, aggressive against somebody and just assault them. And then everybody jumps on the assault wagon and just keeps attacking. And it's unreal to me how far people will go with it.
Yeah. Yeah. You know, it comes to the fact that like I said earlier, we are our own worst enemy. If the hunting industry would act more like a community. Like, honestly, like we do band together. We just saw it happen here in with the Colorado thing that we were involved in with the Mountain Lions. We saw a big outreach. We saw a coming together. But that was done with thousands of people. Maybe a million people, you know, like total. It was more than that, I guess, for votes. So I don't remember how many votes it got total, but let's just say 2 million. Okay. There's 14 million hunters in the United States. Then I'm going to be, you know, outrageous here, but let's say if 14 million hunters were locking arms and singing Kumbaya together about everything we did, we would be a force to be reckoned with.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. You know, that's one of our downfalls. And the other side, anti-hunting establishment, knows this very well. They pit us against each other all the time. And I'm going to oversimplify this, but like, you see bills come out that have hunters on both sides of the fence of it. I mean, from what I research and what I've observed, 90 some odd percentile will side, that bill will go to the anti-hunting side. So just to give you, I use this as an example all the time. Here in Arizona, a few years ago, we banned the use of trail cameras. There was hunters on both sides of it. Well, anti-hunters don't want us to use trail cameras. So as soon as they saw that it was a split, of course they jumped on the side of the hunters that wanted to get rid of the, you know, because it suited them. Like, they boom, there. Same thing goes with the bears and the lions and so on, because there's so many of us that don't bear hunt. So many of us don't lion hunt, and it's not seemingly important to us.
Yeah.
So we don't ever look at hunting as a whole. We don't say, oh, you know, this is important to hunting. No, this is, I just don't do that. I don't go hunt lion hunting. I don't go bear hunting. I'm a deer hunter. I'm a, you know, gator hunter, whatever I am, you know, and that's where, and you know, a lot of that's human nature, but that's where the crux of our problem is as a community, is that we're really not a community.
Well, and even important to the natural resource, I think sometimes we can't get out of our own head. I know in our state, in Oregon, people always want to blame Oregon Department of Fish and Wildlife for everything, you know, no matter how things are going, it's ODFW's fault.
Always.
And that's one of my pet peeves. It's like, they have a budget. They're constrained by all these interest groups are trying to keep happy and some legal requirements. And they're doing the best they can. Most people that work for Oregon Department of Fish and Wildlife are hunters and fishermen, you know, themselves. So they want to do the best they can.
The departments are usually very good. Some of the commissions, like you guys are seeing that in the Pacific Northwest.
The commissions might be a different story.
So you guys are seeing that in the Pacific Northwest, especially Washington right now, your neighbor.
Yep.
There's been some info.
It's the governor, extremely anti-hunting governors.
Exactly. But so, for instance, right now we have a somewhat anti-hunting governor right now in Arizona. Definitely not of, and I don't want to make this a political thing, but if you were to look at, you know, Republicans and Democrats, most of the Democratic politicians are not 100% in favor of hunting type stuff. Not all of them. I mean, hell, Pittman Robertson came from Democratic senators. Yeah. So, you know, you can't make it about that, but I'm just to make my point anyway. Our governor is not the most, friendly towards, she's not an anti-hunter. Well, at least that hasn't shown that she is anyway. But we have a process here. And if we were to implement this process across the United States or something similar to it, or even better than it is, we have, it's called CARB is the acronym.
CARB, it's, like the fish?
No, like CARB, like your carburetor. Like
carbohydrates?
Oh, yeah. Like a carburetor. Okay. Yep.
I think that's what it is. I might be wrong. So don't hold me to that part. But what it is it's made up of ranchers, outfitters, and people who are in the know, so to speak, that have these positions and represent a broader. They select, let's say, a handful of candidates, and they say, okay, here are the candidates that you can choose from. It's basically like that. I might be speaking a little bit out of turn, but it's something along those lines. What that does is it prevents the governor from saying, hey, I want my cousin Bill to be the next commissioner.
Yeah, yeah. And that's, there's no nepotism. There's no system, is what you're saying.
And that's the kind of stuff that I think would be an easier bridge to cross. Like, a lot of people would love to see the right to hunt and fish put in every state. I think there's 24 now, if I remember right. We just got one passed here in Florida this past election cycle, yep. that's a lot of harder hill to climb.
Yeah.
But a good way to protect a lot of the hunting and fishing stuff is putting the right people in the commissioner's chair, you know? And in order to do that, if you have a process that makes it hard for them to just willy-nilly pick anybody, and you have a process that has the candidates that are best suited for this type of, you know, position, I think those are a lot easier to implement.
Yeah.
You know, because those can happen. Some of them, I mean, every state's a little different, but some of them would have to be statutory, but some of them is just commission change rules, you know?
Mm.
And those can be done.
Yeah.
It gives you hope.
Yeah.
There's some ways.
Yeah.
We're getting pretty deep there too. And it's really like creating a perfect bridge to start talking about Howell. Before we jump into that though, just going to take a quick pit stop and encourage anyone who's listening to this to, check out, our social medias and help share our shows. Cause you know, as much as me nor Sam are in this to create some sort of a money-making big thing, but it does encourage us to continue going when more people enjoy our shows, you know, because we put a lot of effort into this thing. And, you know, so if you'd be willing to share our show with someone that you know that likes hunting and fishing, it'll go a long way. So this is Oregon First Hunting and Fishing and Sam's show.
It's Outdoor Adventures Podcast.
Our listenership can continue to support what Howell is doing and what John is doing by checking out Days in the Wild podcast and also howlforwildlife.org, where you can get all that information there.
Thank you.
So
I'm gonna do you guys a solid. I'm gonna re-air this on my podcast too. So
awesome.
Oh, wow. All right.
Cool. I love it.
Yeah, that's great.
Sweet.
Well, yeah, thank you. My podcast originated out of just airplane flight and was listening to Meat Eater, and I just really wanted to hear him talk to the whitetail hunter that had killed like the, I don't know, second largest whitetail or something. And it was going and going and going. And I'm like, I got to do my own podcast.
So you could ask the whitetail hunter
and just listen to him talk, let him go. Yeah, there was nothing wrong with the way it went down. I just decided I wanted to do my own and get some of our stories. And it's become a way just to get some of those audio moments with my family. And it's been pretty neat.
Yeah. Well, here's a quick look at the news. So locally, we like to cover Oregon outdoor news stories just to keep everyone in the know about what's going on. And the Mule Deer Foundation has recently launched the Blacktail Foundation. Now, I joined right away because obviously blacktail, that's just direct crosshair of my world. And so, I mean, it was good on them. They probably unleashed a whole new base because I would have probably never joined the Mule Deer Foundation. There's a bunch of other different wildlife related conservation organizations that I would have been a part of before that. But then they launched the Blacktail Foundation. And so I jumped right in, and that's the reason I joined. So far, out of it, you know, I got to help fund some projects they're doing up in Southeast Alaska, but, I also got a hat that I'm wearing right now. So, you know, I mean, sure. Thanks, guys. I hope didn't take too much money out of my, you know, but yeah, like I mentioned, they're doing work in Southeast Alaska. They did this cool thing where they used thermal drones to find deer and then they darted them and put collars on them to learn more about habitat usage and range. Cause you know, I think that's one of the challenges that they're probably going to face with launching a blacktail specific organization like this, is that there's not very many blacktail hunters, and also blacktail are doing really well, at least here in for the Columbia blacktail. I don't really know anything about Sitka blacktail, which are the ones up in Alaska, but down here in Oregon, you know, blacktail are doing good. People wish that they were managed for bigger ones, but if you want big blacktail, just go to Southern Oregon or Northern California. If you want a lot of blacktail, come up here to Northwestern Oregon.
Or go deeper in,
you know. People don't like to hear that, though. There's no projects in Oregon yet. Our closest chapter to here in Salem, they have one in Albany, and they are starting a chapter in Canby as well. Some things, I just kind of want to give some information so people can know more about them. Oregon and Washington are lumped together as far as oversight goes. So there's Ryan Krapp from North Dakota is the regional conservation coordinator for Oregon and Washington. And I don't know. Maybe it's because it's so fresh and new, and I really hope that they get more West Coast and PNW guys leading this thing, and that it's not just a secondary thought from the Mule Deer Foundation, where they have all these guys from places like North Dakota don't have blacktail leading it. So, I mean, that's one thing for me, that looking at this new effort. But it is a new effort, so we have to give them a lot of grace.
Sure.
That they're working with, you know, their own resources and trying to get it started. There's a guy, John Wesley, he's the closest one to us from Washington. He's listed as a team member for the Oregon and Washington section. And those are two of eight leadership team members specifically for the Blacktail Foundation. Now, a quick distinction is that blacktail deer have always been a part of the mission of the Mule Deer Foundation, but they've kind of a lot of Western, far Western, because, you know, the West includes Idaho and Colorado and Wyoming and all those places, but far Western, like the coastal guys, have kind of felt like blacktail have been overlooked in that mission. And so I think that from what I gathered, that is also a part of the intention of this, is to give some special attention to the blacktail. And I do agree. It's probably about time blacktail get some representation, because they're an awesome deer species and we love them. And, you know, we don't want to have to react to trials. So if blacktail start doing really bad, you know, we don't want to have to try to create something new to react to it. It's going to be great to have stuff in place that is already advocating for blacktail. But I am a little concerned that we might still get overlooked. I mean, considering Sitka, Alaska blacktail versus Oregon Coast, Columbia blacktail, you know, I'm really hoping that as this progresses and continues, it'll grow to where they're doing a lot more in Oregon, because at this point they're not doing anything yet. But like I said, got to have some grace because it's new. Yeah. But, you know, let's keep an eye on that.
Well, and I'll tell you, I did a little research on this. The guys over at Camo and Wind were wanting to start a blacktail foundation. And so I did a fair amount of research. And Mule Deer Foundation always had in their mission statement, it talked about mule deer and blacktail as part of it.
Yeah.
But now they made this distinction. So I think the challenge that we were looking at is, like you said earlier, the population is doing good. Everything seems good. Public access, at least in Oregon, is decent.
In Oregon,
so,
for sure, yeah.
You know, where are you going to focus your energy? And ours was going to be mostly on access for the animals and trying to make those relationships even stronger or better than they are today.
Yeah, with the private timber company owners, because I'm not sure, John, how aware you are of the way things work on the Oregon coast.
I've helped hunted timberland quite a bit, yeah.
Yeah, so, I mean, but we're, at least here in Northwest Oregon, it's even different in Southwest Washington. There's a lot more pay to play, but we're so blessed with like so many timber companies that, you know, it's getting more and more constricted. And that's where we really need the advocacy for blacktail hunters, is working with the timber companies to say, like Sam brought up a great idea. What if we put together some funds privately to install bear-proof trash containers, like large ones, that, you know, we took the expense of taking the trash out of there? Because one of the number one reasons, and I agree, I hate it when I go up there and there's just piles of trash.
Yeah.
People just go and dump. Or what if we created some sort of a slush fund for people who would dump their trash, but instead we paid to take it to the dump?
But going to those private timber companies and saying, hey, what are the things that drive you the most insane about giving hunters access to your property? And garbage is the first thing that came to mind for me.
Yeah.
Or just not treating it like it's your own backyard, treating it, you know, with the lack of respect.
Every
and
time I see a busted open gate, I just get so mad, because that is just another check, you know, another strike. And it's eventually, I've seen that. There's actually a specific road that I used to hunt a lot up where I grew up that was usually open. And people would drive in and hunt, which, you know, people always want that. I like to walk in, but, you know, but it opened up a whole area that you could reach better. And they would close the gate sometimes, and someone actually busted through the gate, and they said, all right, that's it. The gate's always shut now.
Yeah.
And,
yeah.
You know.
That's goes back to what I was saying earlier, that we're our own worst enemy. Like, it's not only the hunters on hunters. You guys got to think – not just you two, but all of us have to think about the perception that people who don't have hunt have, right? All they have is what these anti-hunters, which have been doing way, way, way better job than us at talking to the non-hunting public, and they've been painting a picture of you as this, you know, guy who willy-nilly goes out there, you know, drinking beers and just hating wildlife, hating, you know, habitat, and just careless person, right? Yep. And they've done that through mainstream media. They've done that in movies. They've done that in countless ways. Mm-hmm. And that is something that we are combating, what Howl for Wildlife is combating. We're trying to reach and bridge the gap between the non-hunting public and hunters. But as hunters, we need to realize that we're ambassadors of what we do. Yeah. And if we want to be perceived as the protectors of wildlife, conservationists, you know, people who love the wild, the outdoors and stuff like that. If you want people to know that about you, you have to show that to them. And how you do that is how you present yourself out there. Like, you can't do stuff like what you just said, or you can't go out and leave a bunch of shotgun shells and garbage down on the ground because you were shooting skeet or whatever the case may be.
Or go four wheeling behind closed gates and
whatever. You can just stick in there anything that you've been introduced to. And it sucks because hunting is such a hard endeavor that people, in order to succeed, it goes back to what we were talking about earlier. You want to take shortcuts. You want to do things. Sure. You want the easy road somehow because you want to be able to show, especially today's day and age with social media, you want to be able to show, I'm the big macho man. I got this, you know, whatever. And in order to do that, sometimes you feel like you need to do these things to get to that point, right? You need to drive behind a closed gate, or you need to hunt 10 minutes past the light restriction, or whatever the case may be. Yeah. And, you know, so it's like, one, somebody's always watching. Somebody's always watching. And you're going to do stuff that might be in the gray, or you're going to do stuff that's unsavory. Somebody's going to see it. It's going to get videoed. And you're going to get used as an example. And now, instead of being an ambassador of hunting, you're a poster boy for anti-hunting.
Has that personally happened to you, John?
No.
Like, have you experienced? No, good.
No, I mean, like I said earlier, I got my own little band of, I don't know if I said this exactly, but I have my own little band of haters that always like to make things up, which is almost not as bad, obviously, because there's videos and evidence that goes out there that
shows the true story,
tells the true story, right? And then there's people that come up with their own stuff. If you're out there doing these things, like, for instance, last year, that was the, I don't know if you guys heard of it or not, and I don't really like to bring it up, to be honest with you, but there was a guy in Wyoming that ran over a wolf with its
I heard that story.
Yeah, with his, you know, his skidoo or whatever. And that in itself is a bad action, whether or not in this it's legal to do in this specific spot of the state, because it's considered a predator management area. He then proceeded to take that wolf, paraded it around town, and brought it into a, you know, establishment.
You're still alive at that point.
And doing all kinds of stuff. So what happened? Now, this is, you just gave anti-hunting, like, oh my God, golden goose. I'm going to run with this. This is awesome. Uh-huh. Now you just became that guy. Yeah. You could be, you know, straight as an arrow, follow every rule, do everything perfectly, you know, and now you are that person because they sensationalize that. They take it, they bring it, you know, this is what hunters are. This is what we need to protect. We need to protect wildlife from, you know, even though that's the one bad seed that made the whole, you know, orchard look bad, you know?
Yep.
I do think this platform, the podcasting platform, has helped open the eyes of some of my friends that weren't hunters. So when we first started just sharing our stories and why we do what we do, and you know, the family and the legacy and the tradition and just all the things we love about hunting and being out in the woods, some of my friends that weren't hunters or not necessarily against it, but didn't understand why I did it, they're like, I finally get it now. You know? So, I mean, that is the cool part about this platform that we have to be able to share our stories, is those of us that, and they may not even be full on anti-hunters, but they perceive us a particular way when they see us post a photo or something.
The majority are not anti-hunting.
Yeah, and now they hear it and they hear what we do and they're like, oh, I finally am understanding why they are the way they are.
Well, yep. You know, here's the thing, like there's so many things that go on hunters take for granted or that hunters don't even know about that partake in hunting that the anti-hunter or not, excuse me, that non-hunters don't know anything, like completely nothing about. So let me quick, I've used this example so many times, but it's such a great example. Last February when we were at the Mule Deer Expo, we were taking Ubers back and forth to dinners and whatever banquets and so on and so forth. And every time we were in an Uber, and I said, me and the Hal crew, Charles and Mike and Everett and Logan and Jared and whatever, we would engage with the drivers.
Yeah.
And they were always non-hunters and they always had questions, uh-huh. You know, and it was very easy to draw a line that none of these people knew that there was tags.
Really?
That the ones that knew that there was about tags thought a tag represented a dead animal.
Mm.
They don't know that there's a 9% chance of you killing an elk, you know,
yeah.
If you got a tag, yeah. It's just an opportunity.
Man.
I'm going to take us on a sideline for a second here. Dan Gates, he put it this way one time and I love it. He's like, if I told you that you had to pay $900 to go inside Whole Foods and you had a 9% chance of coming out with food, would you do it?
Yeah.
That's the reality of it. Yeah. Anyway, yeah. So we would engage, going back
that
to the
Whole
story.
Foods is on the top of a giant mountain with a beautiful view and yeah. You get to go camping and stuff, right?
Exactly. You know, every time we talked to them, they thought, you know, you just went out and grabbed a gun and just went out. There's no seasons. There's no lottery. There's no, you know, none and, of these yeah. like little things that we take for granted that because mm-hmm. we know the system and a lot of us yeah. don't even know. I'm not even talking
don't know
about
any different.
Not even talking about the North American model of wildlife conservation, you know, that the more intricate stuff, they don't know anything about these. So how are we to expect them to understand what it is that we do if they don't even have a glimpse of what it is that we do, yeah. You know, and it's so easy for the anti-hunters to put out propaganda, put out misinformation and all this stuff. And it's just, you know how things work, especially nowadays. Like if you put up a meme, you put up this, it captures people. Like you're seeing yeah. it in mainstream politics. You see it in everything. And the first person that gets to that, to get to that person that doesn't know, with their information, they're usually the ones that capture that person's ideal, you know, yeah. or their beliefs, or at least their thought process. So if somebody grows up and they think that hunters just go out there, shoot stuff and lop heads off and leave it out there in the woods, that's what they're going to think, you know,
yeah.
They don't know
yeah.
any better. So what we need to do as a community is to one by one, start changing that perception. Mm. And you do that by one, educating yourself on how the inner workings of conservation is and what it means and what hunting, how hunting is used as a tool and the benefits of hunting. Educate yourself on all that stuff. So you're armed with that information. If somebody asks you, you haven't, you know, more importantly, you need to start thinking about like a 30-second spiel or something. If I was to come to you and say, hey, what does hunting mean to you?
Yeah.
You know how to answer that.
Yeah, it's like your mission statement in a professional life. You know, you have to have your mission statement, exactly. Your value statement ready to go.
Mm. Yeah. So, this is not to toot my own horn, but this is an example. I was just recently at a family birthday party. Now, mind you, these are family members. They're related to my brother-in-law, but not my family specifically.
I was able to invite.
Well, I went there for a birthday party, and yeah. My son had just killed a black buck in December in Texas.
Huh.
I took him for his first big game hunt and he got one.
Say that. What was it again?
Black buck. Black buck. Yeah.
I've never heard of that.
It's an exotic. There's only, okay. You know, only a few places in the United States you can kill one. It's an antelope species.
Cool.
They're about 80 pounds soaking wet.
Wow.
They're small, very agile, cool looking.
And he was successful.
Yes.
On his first. Yeah. Awesome.
8 years old.
Wow.
Almost did it with the bow. Almost did it with the bow too.
Whoa.
Yeah.
Man.
But we ended up switching to the rifle on the last day. Anyway, so I smoked up one of his back straps. We prepared it, him and I together. We brought it there and we were serving it. We were having conversations and telling people about his endeavor and how he enjoyed it. And this is the meat. Everybody's like, oh, I love this. It's so good. And at the end of it, two of my brother-in-law's cousins just asked me if I would take them on an elk hunt to go get meat.
Really?
So wow. We just applied them for the Arizona cow hunts.
Oh, cool.
Sweet.
2 days ago. Yeah. So yeah. Like, this is what I'm talking about. Like, you have to have these conversations. Sometimes they might go over people's heads and people might just yes you to death and don't really care about what you have to say, but you have these conversations and more often than not, you'll have an impact. And whether that's, very obvious, like I just had, I had two guys who want to, try hunting now. And hunting because they want the meat, which is even better, right?
Yeah. No kidding.
Well, and the meat is fantastic for those that haven't eaten it. It's, I take for granted sometimes that I grew up with that lifestyle and had that privilege of learning the hunt and valuing the meat and using all the meat. And I know we've probably gone in different directions than you were planning on today, Bryant, but we've seen
I've just been
some
making X's on the questions like, oh, covered right. that, covered that. Okay. So.
But I mean, we've had, you see those guys where a guy does a really good job on a gut list. And he gets a lot of meat off, but you're still going to leave some meat. And then people are hating on that. Look at all that meat they left in the woods because they just don't know. They just haven't experienced it and they don't know that most of us at hunt, at least my perspective is always to bring home some meat because I love the meat and I always eat through it faster than I want to.
Yep.
And so I want every scrap I can get off of that animal. If I'm going to harvest an animal, every piece of that animal I want to use if I can.
Well, a lot of people who consume podcasts are actually hunter curious, like they haven't hunted yet, or they're new hunters. Like, for example, we actually run a club here in town called Salem First Hunting and Fishing Club, kind of based off of Oregon First podcast. But and we just did a duck hunt in December. That was actually this month in January. We did a duck hunt. We had 11 guys come out for that. And at the beginning of the morning, I said, raise your hand if you've ever duck hunted before. And two hands went up. So we had 9 first-time duck hunters out there that we, some of them had done some big game hunting. Some of them, it was their first ever hunt ever. And, it's super cool to do that. But it's like you're saying, those people maybe a year ago before they started this journey of meeting hunters and realizing that they live in a natural world where they're connected to their food system, that they could take out the middleman and really, I found that for a lot of hunters lately, that's been the drive. Like when I ask them why they want to start hunting, it's, especially if they didn't grow up in a hunting family, the answer is usually because I want to harvest my own meat.
Sure.
And, a lot of us are disgusted by factory farming and we want to break out of that system and we want to take advantage of these opportunities and the wonderful places that we live to harvest meat, And so all that for what both you guys are saying, most hunters that have been hunting for a long time or grew up hunting, it's really hard sell to try to convince them to open up their lives to new hunters.
Yeah.
And
because you don't want more competition. And that's exactly the biggest thing. That's why R3 has such a hard time doing well, because we already
say what that is again.
R3 is recruit. I forgot exactly what it is, exactly the words, but it's basically
retain,
recruit, and reactivate, I think it is.
Okay.
Something along those lines. And basically what it is it's a program to bring more hunters into and not only keep more hunters that are already or historically have been hunter in hunting. It's something we need. We can't keep going further and further into obscurity. Like we're already only 5% of the population. Now the same thing, we can't have too many because hunting can't sustain that. Right. But for this instance, like you got two guys coming in that want to, and of course I don't know what 100% certainty, but I know in my gut that these are two guys that'll do it, once in a blue moon, and they're going to do it because they want to do it for the meat. And that's great. I know we don't want to recruit another, I don't want to recruit another John Stallone that spends 90 days a year in the field and is going to be chasing the same bucks that I'm chasing. And nobody wants that. Right.
Sure.
And, but you got to understand that you can't have your cake and eat it too. You have to have a voice. You have to have enough people.
I think it'll help kind of get people to adopt your point you're making right now to say that 90% of hunters are not John Stallones. You know, I've met so many guys that, you know, they have their one season that they hunt. Or here in Oregon, a lot of them only hunt when they draw Eastern Oregon tags.
Right.
And
right.
So then they're, you know, they'll sit out. They're fine. You know, I just won't hunt this year because I didn't draw my tags. And, you know, that's a lot of the hunting population. They still love hunting. They're still passionate about it. They still consume media and talk to people, and it's like their thing. But they're not all John Stallones who are killing all the animals.
Yeah, I was that hunter for the first 20 years of my hunting career. I didn't draw an Eastern Oregon tag, I didn't hunt. And that was, you know, just
there's nothing wrong with that. And in fact, first 20 years. I like that because as soon as they made Eastern Oregon draw only for archery elk, suddenly there's a lot more trucks at gates here on the west side. But, you know,
the whole point is you have to have people who understand what you do and why you do it. That way, when they're faced with, you know, propaganda from anti-hunting that is trying to eliminate hunting, they will see that and say, that's BS. I know that's BS.
Yep.
You know, I've partaken in hunting, or I know John, I know, you know, Brian, and he's a good guy, whatever, you know, whatever. It's just, they know, they've been exposed to the truth, they've been exposed to reality, and now they're not easily consumed by the BS.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
And the only way that we can effectively, I hate it to put it this way, but win this war is going back to what I had said earlier. You need to have this, you need to understand that you're an ambassador. You need to have these experiences, and be able to speak with non-hunting public so that when they leave that conversation, they have a positive view of what hunting is and who hunters are. Really, I mean, like I said, there's 14 to 16 million, depending on who you talk to, in the United States. And there's what, 330, 340 million of us total in the United States. I don't even know anymore, but
I don't even know.
You know, 10, 20 years, you can effectively educate a lot of people if you were doing one person a year.
Yeah.
And it, like you said, if we link arms and band together, you know, and that's
which is what the anti-hunters do. We don't do that.
Yeah. And so, that kind of brings it back, because the point you were making earlier before we took the news break was about hunter unity. Mm-hmm. And how the anti-hunters identify the splits and then they attack. So there's sort of two main themes I'm hearing from you in this conversation so far, is that hunter unity between hunters is vitally important, and also us viewing ourselves individually as ambassadors for the non-hunters in our lives is also important. So I think that's a good transition there into Howell, and asking more specifically, because I mean, one of the main reasons you're on is because we want to learn more about what Howell does. How do you guys work for hunter unity and providing a opportunity for us to kind of work together against the anti-hunting movement?
Like a pack of wolves, it was done for several different reasons, but like a pack of wolves that howl together, it's like one voice, one howl. It's like a one pack mentality. That was the reason behind it. And the other reason behind it was, why should anti-hunting champion one of the most apex predators on the landscape, which is a wolf, why is that their animal? Like, they're always, so we wanted that to be our animal.
Yeah.
You know,
take it back.
Exactly. And so going back to the original one voice, one howl, what Howell does, we do a lot of things, but one of the mainstays of what we do is we provide knowledge, you know, the information, the ability to have your voice be heard on issues that may impact hunting and fishing. Either ability or wildlife management decisions, so on and so forth. And so what does that mean? Like, you come to Howell for Wildlife, we put up an action, we'll just say they're trying to get rid of snipe hunting in Oregon. And, you know,
those are real birds, you know.
Yeah, I know. But they come, you know, we do the research. This is why we do it. This is what it, you know, the benefits of it, and so on and so forth. And you come in there and you support that. You put your name and your email address in, and it sends off a pre-drafted email to the decision makers of that, you know, that are on that policy, whatever that policy is, whatever level it's at. And it's super effective. Because it comes from you, not from hell. You can edit it. You can make it your own. You can add your own twist to it. You know, hey, I'm a father of four, whatever. And we do this because I put food on my table with it, whatever the case may be. And, but it goes to the decision makers. And historically before that, you saw a lot of like, hey, contact your senator, contact your whatever about this issue. And you'd go to your senator. First off, nobody knows who the hell who's their senator or their congressman. Person or the, you know, like you got to go searching for that, right? So you go searching for that information and you finally get a hold of them and they're like, okay, this is great, but I have nothing to do with this. I'm not on that committee. I'm not part of this decision-making process. I can't do anything for you. So it falls on deaf ears. So we've identified the people that need to hear it the most and we made it come directly from you to them and we've given you the tools to make it as compelling of an argument as possible. That's the crux of what HAL does. We, and we do that basically for free. You don't have to be a member to be to take part in any of that.
Because I was on your guys's website and it's amazing the amount of stuff you have up there, you know, everything from like education as far as you can learn about the different things and, you know, be more it's funny I phrased it that way, you can speak better, be more well-spoken about
I don't speak very well issues. So I get it, trust me.
About all those kind of issues from predator management to the North American model wildlife conservation to even specific issues such as bills against bear hunting and whatnot. You guys have so much information up there, so that way you can know more about, you know, the perspective of a hunter and how to phrase it and whatnot. And then you have all those other resources of the emails to send, the people to contact, and
sure.
And I've been that guy trying to reach out to a congressman or a person on the House or the Senate, and it like you get exactly how you described it. You get a hold of the clerk tells you, oh, that's not really his thing, and then you kind of feel deflated because it took you 15 calls to even get to that
right
one.
Exactly. And nobody's and even gonna do what you did, and God bless you for trying, you know. But most people, they want something that's simple. I mean, what we did is we created the easy button. We made it easy for people to be made the bar really low to step over. You don't have to even go under it. Just step over the bar and be active, have your part, you know, because that's the other way we save this. You know, we save this by being involved and not just involved in the things that we think mean something to us. We can't, you know, only do this because we're snipe hunters. You know, the deer hunters got to come out for the snipe hunters, the, you know, the blind hunters have, that's the way it works. We're all in this together. I can spend an exorbitant amount of time connecting the dots from you, but just hear me say it. We're all in this together. And it really does affect, you know, the guy in Florida who gator hunts really affects the guy in Oregon who blacktail hunts. It really, we're really interconnected. That's one of the things that we do. One of the other things we do is we act as a conduit to bring state level issues to a national level. And that's, again, it's emboldening that community mindset. So for instance, in Colorado, this past election cycle, that was a state level issue. It would have stayed there. Guaranteed, most people would not have heard of that had HAL not done what we do, brought it to a national level. By the end of it all, we had people from every state had made a donation. We had people from every state who got involved. And we were able to activate people in Colorado to actually come out and do and vote our way, which is what, you know, and then we weren't telling you what to vote. We were just providing you the tools and providing you the information and making, you know, building awareness around it.
It's really cool. How long have you guys been in existence?
January 2021.
Man, it's amazing. The last 4 years then. I mean, you're, as far as someone who's in the know about hunting advocacy, you guys are kind of one of the top names out there that are brought up. So that's amazing.
I don't think we were even in official capacity 2022.
And what got you to the point of, hey, we need to do this? Like, how did it come about?
Charles is the president, Charles Whitwam. And, we hunt together a lot and, you know, we had always been musing back and forth. Back in 2016, I had this idea, wanted to do like, the Hunter Up initiative. And it was about this community thing, about us being better to each other and so on and so forth. And, it never came to fruition. I'm not going to get into details about it, but, and sometime in 2020, it was in either 2020 or 2021. I don't know. The dates, don't hold me accountable for dates because I'm bad at this stuff. and I'm bad at statistics too. But there was a governor, or not governor, excuse me, a senator, Senator Weiner in California. That's not a, that's an actual name.
My principal in elementary school was Dr. Weiner. So.
Oh, really? That's hilarious. Yep. The HSUS got in his ear and said, oh, you're going to be super popular if you get rid of bear hunting in California. You know, that's what politicians do. They want to be popular.
Yeah.
So he brought this bill in the legislature about getting rid of bear hunting. Charles had called me. He's like, hey, they're trying to get rid of bear hunting in California. What can we do? I said, well, you know, I know people, you know people. Let's put together something on the change.org platform and let's get it out there. And the beauty of it was actually the way Charles wrote it. He wrote it how it was protecting wildlife, keeping the bear hunting. Mm-hmm. He wrote it in a very specific way, but we put it out there. And the other thing about it is that the within change.org, you can direct who you want the emails to be sent to. And, you know, we were able to get, Charles was able to get, you know, Senator Weiner's direct email and all this other stuff. So within 5 days, we had 20,000 people sign that petition.
Wow.
Yeah, or more than that. It might have been, I can't even remember now, but obviously he dropped it like a hot rock and
said, I don't want to mess with it.
Yeah. So that was the that was the realization right there that there was power. We had the power to do this and we had the ability to organize to do it.
Yeah.
So from that, I was like, we need to start a change.org for hunters specifically. And
that's awesome.
It kind of grew from that. And a lot of the inner workings, Charles spent a lot of time trying to figure out how to make it work with technology and so on and so forth. And, you know, a lot of sleepless nights back and forth and figuring out things and how it was born.
And as he's talking, you know, as he's describing it, you're picturing this wolf pack, you know, all howling, you know, where my mind goes. Cause once you connect the dots for people, it's pretty easy to see what you're trying to do.
Does Howl, like, we're talking a lot about defense and fighting against the like restrictions that are coming. Is there any kind of time that Howl has stepped up in the offense and trying to help promote some more hunting liberties?
Absolutely. Yeah, we've done Sunday hunting stuff. We've done on the East Coast. We just did Florida.
Yeah, isn't that so weird? I mean, maybe some of our Oregon listeners don't realize this, but there's states where you can't hunt on Sundays.
Yeah.
It's so wild.
Still several.
You didn't know that? Yeah.
It's they're old blue laws, you know.
I know when I go pheasant hunting in, I think, South Dakota, we can't hunt as non-residents till noon.
There's plenty of some of them have like management reasoning. Like I know turkey, sometimes there's turkey restrictions. You can't, that's because they don't want you shooting them off the roost and you know, or waiting for them at a roost tree or whatever. There's certain reasons for that. And then
like the 1 p.m. shut off in wherever. Yeah.
Some of those are
weird. Did you know about that one, Sam? Yeah, there's I think Georgia's, I might be wrong. I think it's one of those states where you
there's several. California is one of them. Oh, wow. You got to be done by
five.
Oh. You can't. So like basically the last, you know, hour or two of flight.
Yeah.
You can't, because that, again, it comes back. They don't want you, you know, they know they're going to the same roost tree or whatever. You can't sit there and wait for them to come.
Got it. So, yeah. Well, and on that point, you know, one of the biggest pressing issues that every hunter I have met has an issue with, it's the fact that back in the early 90s, Oregon, the voters of Oregon outlawed the use of hounds for bear, cougar, and also in that same measure, it banned bear baiting. So you can still bait for cougars. A lot of people don't know that. And it does work, according to Joe Lewis. It really has impacted largely the way that we're able to manage our wildlife. And even, you know, you'd think, yeah, it affects the predator populations are big, so it has conflicts with humans. But more of what the hunters are concerned about is the wildlife. And Sam, you've been working on something to try to take care of that.
Yeah, I appreciate you teeing that up for me. So it was in 1994, Measure 18 that passed, and it was by a narrow margin, but it banned the use of dogs to hunt, you know, bear and cougar, and there was all this anti-hunting propaganda. I was a 15-year-old kid. You would see these videos of the mama bear running up the tree with cubs and this hunter shooting it out of a tree and the bear rolling down the hill.
That's what they do.
You know, and that was back in the day of where we had rabbit ears for the TVs, you know, and things like that. But TV to me was a lot more influential back then than it is now, because a lot of people don't pay attention to commercials. They're finding ways to avoid them. And so, but anyway, I did a little research on this because we started talking. So I don't know, John, if you know, but in 2026, the mule deer hunting specifically in Eastern Oregon is going to be changing. So they're going to take us from, right now we have 44 units to hunt, and they're going to take it down to 22. And it's the same geography, but they're consolidating. And because they're trying to get our mule deer population under control. And Bryant is a better statistics guy than me, but I want to say we have like around 160,000 mule deer. Is that the number that is in your head?
I can't remember. I just read the mule deer plan and I forgot.
Yeah. So they put out this really large mule deer plan. Most of us as hunters weren't really paying attention, even though there was public meetings and things like that, until we got our 2025 synopsis. And then we all of a sudden saw these map changes and people started posting it on all the forums. Is this really happening? You know, and it specifically only impacts rifle mule deer hunting in the state of Oregon in 2026, but it's not fully defined yet. We don't exactly know where the boundaries are. And it's due to the concern and that the populations are either declining or barely growing. And so, you know, as hunters, most hunters want to blame the predators for that. And so there's all these statistics out there, and you can read the Mule Deer Plan at, you know, the Oregon Fish and Wildlife website. And the problem is the data sample sizes are so small that you really, they're doing the best they can with the resources that they have, but the reality is it's really hard to see. So I started digging into this Measure 18 just out of curiosity. And initially I thought I had to propose a whole nother measure because it'd been so long since 1994. I mean, we're talking 30 years, you know, is that right? Is that mathing? Yeah. So it was 30 years ago. And, you know, so what was cool, I was able to pull up the old ballot measure and read some of the people that were against it at that time. And, you know, it's Oregon Hunters Association, the Mule Deer Foundation, those type of folks. And this one guy puts out there at the time, cougars were estimated at 2,900 animals in Oregon, and the population was growing at 4% a year. So I just threw that in a quick spreadsheet. If that statistic still holds true, we have 9,700 cougars now. But we still say we have 2,500. That's just the number we throw out there. And I'm not ragging on anybody. Maybe that's accurate, maybe it's not. But an adult male cougar harvests one deer every 10 to 14 days. And so just using that 2,500 number on one deer harvested every 14 days, that's 65,000 a year that cougars would be taking out of the mule deer population. Specifically, mule deer is the kind of their favorite food, or the ones that they seem to go after the most. I'm sure they're getting blacktail too.
Oh yeah. Oh, but, yeah. I mean, it's statewide.
Yeah. And so, you know, and then we're number five in the nation as far as the quantity of black bears. And there are a lot of black bear hunters, but we have over 30,000 black bears in the state of Oregon as well. And Bryant was the one that told me, you know, the fawn predation from black bears is pretty intense. And there's a YouTube that I don't recommend watching because it'll make you want to be a bear hunter. But this black bear is eating a fawn, and it's very graphic, but it's, and not that I'm anti wildlife and nature doing its thing, but the point is everybody shows the cute little bear, the, you know, when they're going against these things, and they show these mean snarling hounds that are chasing this mama bear up a tree. And the reality is by passing that law, we've hurt our other population. Deer
so
specifically.
That's very, very similar to what's going on in California, which is your neighbor. They actually did a very extensive study, and I don't see why Oregon wouldn't be able to use a lot of that data. But what they found is that bears actually steal, when there's a large population of bears, they steal mountain lion kills, which causes mountain lions to actually kill more than that one every 14 days.
Wow. That's a big deal factor.
Yeah. So, the declining deer populations may very well have to be, you know, be associated with the predator numbers, and almost always is.
Well, and they cited that in the mule deer plan. I think what Sam wants to ask you, someone from Howell who's dealt with a lot of legislation, is how have you seen these things be successful? I know we're running low on time, so just kind of want to bring it in for landing and ask for some advice for you.
It totally could be successful. Again, I'm going to use California as an example. You know, they banned mountain lion hunting there, and now there's talks of them actually possibly looking at least changing the management plan for them, because they're realizing, and you know, you saw it happen in New Jersey a couple of years ago. The governor banned it, and then he brought it back because they knew the bear's conflict with humans, there's a little different there, but was so high. You can totally win. It's all about providing the science and the truth and getting it out there to the voting population. Mm-hmm. Because that's going to be an initiative, correct? That has to go into a ballot.
Yeah. So, I mean, the cool thing that I found out, the Secretary of State, the lady that happened to be helping me, she was on it. Very, very responsive. We went back and forth. I thought we had to put a whole new ballot together, a whole new measure, but we can actually repeal that vote from 1994, and it's a different process. We can name it whatever we want. We have to cite, you know, the text from that original ballot. And then once the state says I've done the paperwork correctly, then effectively we have to go out and find sponsors. And I don't know what that's involved, but they send you a sponsor packet with a letter, and you send that out to your various sponsors. And then once you get enough sponsorship, and I think I'm assuming that's to cover the cost of printing the ballots and the things that are involved in, I'm sure there's some monetary element to it, and maybe the state makes a little revenue. I don't know exactly how that plays out, but yeah, once you get that, then you go out and gather 4 to 5% of the voting population signatures, and that's the complicated part. And a lot of things fail because they don't have the manpower to get the signatures. You have to validate that it's the actual registered voter signing. You can't have people sign it more than one time. You know, there's these very specific criteria. So we're just at the early phase, and the goal would be on the ballot for November 2026. And I already feel behind, but it just was kind of like a moment when we were talking about this mule deer population, and mule deer are so important to me in my life and my childhood, and I want my kids to be able to experience that and other generations. And I know predators are just one part of the problem, but to me, even coyotes, I mean, this year over east, we were seeing 3 to 5 coyotes a day, and their damage on, and ODFW is doing some controlled quietly coyote eradications, and they're doing some targeted cougar harvests as well. But it's just not getting the job done like it used to get managed when the hound hunting was legal.
Right. Well, there's a lot to unpack there.
And
honestly, I think a lot of that conversation shouldn't be had on a podcast.
Mm-hmm.
Because a lot of it has to do with strategy, and I can guarantee you that there's anti-hunters listening to this podcast because I'm on it. Mm-hmm. We should definitely have a meeting and talk about that. I will say this, and I will say this to the listeners. This is something that could be won. You can get it back.
Mm.
Especially if you have somebody like you who's willing to carry the torch, it can be done. Nobody thought that in Florida with the legislation and the governor and everybody else going on over there, that they can get a right to hunt and fish put in their legislation, mm-hmm. in their constitution. But it happened. You can definitely do this. It's doable. And that is something that the listener should know. We have the power to not only stop anti-hunting, we have the power to bring back things that we lost. As long as the science supports it, we can get behind it and we can make it work. And I don't mean me, Howl for Wildlife. I mean the community, hunting community can get it. Because it takes all of us.
Yeah, it's super encouraging because I think oftentimes you feel like it's too daunting of a task to overcome.
Oh, it is a daunting task, but it's doable. Mm-hmm. It's very doable. So.
Well, that's awesome. Well, you guys will have to have that conversation and, let me know how I can be of support.
I like it. It's like when the president gets asked a military question and he's like, you know, that's a military strategy. We're not going to talk about that.
Yeah.
Exactly. Well, you got to be careful about talking about stuff like that. Like we talked a lot about like how our platform works and stuff. And I really have gotten away from, you know, talking about specifics because of, because of that.
That's smart. Yeah.
You have to.
That's awesome.
Yeah.
Wow.
Thank you guys for having me on, John.
Yeah. Thank you so much for being on. I'll go ahead and plug everything for you about Howl for Wildlife and the call to action there. So thank you for your time. Appreciate it.
Yeah, thanks a lot, John. I wasn't intending to be invited to this, but I feel like just listening to you was a pleasure. So learned a lot.
Thank you.
Yep. So. Yep. Signing out. Thanks for listening.
Talk to you.
Hey guys, before we go, I wanted to say one more big thank you to John Stallone for joining us and being on the show. It was an honor to talk with him and about Howl. I want to give you guys some resources to look at. If you go to howlforwildlife.org, they have all kinds of things for you to help equip you in being a hunting ambassador and also to help unite hunters. You can click on the education tab and there's all kinds of different articles that help explain the hunter's perspective on certain issues such as predator hunting, bear hunting, anti-hunting. Then you could also sign up to be a member. Then you can help them continue on the mission. So I encourage you to go to howlforwildlife.org. While you're sitting at your computer, you can look at John Stallone's website. That's daysinthewild.com. He has a podcast page and a guide page. If you want to hunt with him, he offers tons of hunts in Arizona and South Dakota. And then you can go to his podcast page and listen to his show there where he has on lots of people and you get to hear him talk more about what it takes to save hunting in North America and to protect the North American model of wildlife conservation. Finally, you can find Outdoor Adventures Podcast on Instagram at outdoor.adventures.podcast, and you can follow them there to find their show link as well. They're on Spotify and Apple Podcasts. And you can find Oregon First Hunting and Fishing at OFHF Podcast on Instagram. And there you'll see our link tree. And we have all kinds of different links of opportunities to get together for Salem First Hunting and Fishing Club and lots of other things that we have going on. And you know, for those of us who are in the church, grew up in the church, us Jesus followers, you know, a lot of this talk about unity probably sounds familiar, and that's because actually when Jesus prayed for the church, he prayed for unity, and unity is a huge aspect of what it means to be a Jesus follower. I'll look at even just 1 Corinthians chapter 1 verse 10 says, "I appeal to you, brothers and sisters, in the name of our Lord Jesus Christ, that all of you agree with one another in what you say, and that there be no divisions among you, but that you be perfectly united in mind and thought." And it reminds me of a story someone told me recently of a mission trip they went on where they didn't even really get a chance to talk to the locals yet or do anything. All that they were doing was some work projects to help build homes for people who didn't have the means to build homes. And some kids were just standing by watching, and then before they knew it, there was a bunch of members of the village watching them work, and turns out all of those village members decided to start going to church simply because they were impressed by the unity of the missions crew that was down there doing the work. And you know, as much as that's true in our faith and in the church, it rings true for everything that John was talking about today in hunting as well. And as long as we can be unified, then anyone who's on the outside looking in, they're going to want to be a part of what we're doing. So I hope that's an encouragement to some of you, especially to you church-going folks like me, to kind of give some solid ground as to why unity might be important. Once again, thanks for listening. We'll catch you next episode.